Big old jetliner. We have an expert in this area. Please join me in welcoming Paul Bradbury. He's the director of our very own Portland International Jetport. Welcome, Paul.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
When you were invited, we had your demands for the appearance that you wanted to be introduced with Big Jetliner as your theme music. So I hope that we met that. I'm kidding, of course. But that was a nice intro, right?
That was a very nice intro.
Big old jetliner. You've been here a couple of years ago, so let's catch up a little bit for folks that may not be familiar. I think almost everyone in Maine has some experience with the Jetport. Some people travel more than others, and we were just talking about that. But it's a great asset for not only just Portland, but for Maine and for the region. But before we get there, talk a little bit about how long you have been the airport director, and then let's talk a little bit about what being the airport director entails, and then we'll talk about some of the business impact and what's going on with the airport and the recently completed a couple of years ago new area of the airport and what's up in the future. But talk a little bit about the airport for people that may not be familiar, and how many people fly in and out, how many airlines, and what your job entails as director of the Jetport.
Yes, no, I'd be happy to do so. And thanks again for having me. So, yes, I've been director since 2008. It's really been a great run. 2008, people remember, were when we were just starting what became the largest capital improvement project in the history of the airport, which ultimately came to roughly $163 million over several years. So it was a great time to be airport director, and my background is engineering as well. So it was a very good approach for me, and really a wonderful time to become director at Portland. And we've done some really wonderful things in that period. So it's been just exceptional, and it's been really well received, the new project.
I know you know when you were mentioning 2008, I've been here for about 15 years, and I remember going back to 2001 to 2007 that I am a fairly heavy traveler. And there used to be this phenomena that occurred, I think, most business mornings, but particularly on Monday mornings at 6 a.m. And the phenomena is that all of the gates are full of aircraft and all the airlines are trying to get out their first of the day airlines so they can start their whole schedule and cycle. And so it's the busiest period at the airport. And prior to the new TSA, the new security area, and the new airport, it used to have to walk upstairs, go around a big loop, and then go down through like a balcony area, and then go down other stairs. And it was one of the most painful travel experiences in my life. Deb, had you ever been to the airport when that?
Yes.
And,
yes, indeed.
And part of it had to do with that particular early morning. It's like all the planes are at the gates. So as the day wears on, flights are more staggered. So it was never quite that, that of an intensive experience. But it was so soul-crushing to get there at 4:35 in the morning and face a day of travel, and it was bizarre. Right?
Oh, it was – back then, we would have lines that would back all the way up. It didn't take long to process. But we would have lines that would back up because the security screening just wasn't sized properly for that morning push.
Couldn't have so many screeners that the rest of the day it was wasted resource. So it was kind of a logistics thing. But it was just talking about it. I get kind of depressed and sad. It was so horrible compared to now, where it is incredibly pleasant, very efficient, and it's a great kind of processing experience.
And it has, it really exceeded our expectations because we were able to integrate some really neat features, which were sustainable design elements. We achieved LEED Gold. We introduced some artwork when you come in. It really, and I think that was one of the reasons that Condé Nast readers and users, travelers, rated us 7th in the country. I mean, really brilliant.
Wow. And especially for what would be considered, is it a medium, small size airport compared to obviously Chicago and New York and all that?
Yeah, we're a small hub airport. For us to rank in the top 10 nationally is really brilliant, and part of it is that facility.
Yeah, I want to get to the facility, but talk a little bit about your back as the airport director. Obviously, you have a group of constituents. You have the people who travel through the airport. You have a number of airlines that are all your business partners there at the airport. You have concessions, food, all kinds of stuff. So what does the director of the Portland International Jetport oversee, and how does that intersect with FAA, airlines, and all the other, the aviation part of it versus kind of the business part of it?
It is a really interesting. Airports are these little mini cities, and they're really interesting businesses because you work for many different constituencies. I mean, you have the regulatory, which you mentioned, which is the FAA, our airline partners, which they don't. It's a really interesting product because we don't provide the product that our passengers actually use. The airlines do that.
Right.
So you have this business coordination relationship with the airlines. You're part regulator, part business partner, part enforcer, part – so it really is an interesting job, and that's part of what makes it fun. I mean, it's fun to be at an airport. I think people mostly – they come to the airports and they're really excited by the trip and the travel. It's interesting to see how it all comes together with all these different partners in the airport. So directly for me, there's only 50 employees that work directly for me as the airport director for the city of Portland. But there's nearly 1,000 employees that make the airport work and function and make us achieve our values and give the best customer service product we can. So how do you as airport director do that? You try to develop kind of a shared mission and a customer service environment that helps every employee, regardless of whether you're airline or TSA or one of our concessions or an actual airport working directly for the airport employee. So it's really an interesting management style. And again, every seat flying out of the airport is owned by an airline, one of our airline partners, American, Southwest,
JetBlue. How many do we have now? How many airlines, commercial airlines, now have gates or a presence at the airport?
Sure. So we have American, which was formerly U.S. Airways. People remember that all of this, there's been a lot of changes in it. So it's American, Delta, Southwest, JetBlue, and we just introduced Elite Airways and United.
Wow. So is that number constantly changing with acquisitions and changes, or you're obviously limited the number of gates, so you have a capacity, a finite capacity amount, and then when airlines come or go, you know, how does that work? If there are other gate slot openings that you kind of negotiate with new airlines, or do airlines come to you and buy capacity from other airlines?
So that's a great question. What we do is we assign gates on a preferential basis. So an airline will come to us as what we call a signatory airline if they choose to sign a lease with the Jetport. Every one of those gates are then preferentially assigned. So you could have two preferentially assigned gates. But when you're not using it, I could still assign it to another airline that chooses to bring service to Portland. We would never say no to new service, nor can we actually. We're a public airport. We're open for public. And we try to make the facility meet those demands.
Interesting. You know, which brings up a kind of an interesting question you touched upon the last time you were here. Who owns the airport? And as the director of the Portland International Jetport, who's your boss? I'm guessing the city of Portland. But what many people, I think, aren't aware, because every airport, I believe, has a three-letter designation. Is that right in the airline business?
That is correct. We have the three-letter identifier, and for us, it's PWM.
I know. And this was a trivia question. Do you remember, Deb, what PWM stands for?
Oh, no.
Really?
Really?
You weren't paying attention last year, were you?
I guess I wasn't.
Sully?
Yes?
Sully, do you know?
I do know.
Okay, what is it?
Portland Westbrook Municipal.
Is that right?
Wow, right on.
Right
nailed
on.
It.
And touch, because when you first mentioned this a year and a half ago, I didn't even associate Westbrook with part of it. But back then when it was named, you know, like everything else, wasn't there some sort of political, I don't know if it was a political issue, but there was some desire to make our good friends in Westbrook feel like they were part of the airport, although it's kind of it's kind of counterintuitive, right?
It's very counterintuitive. And those identifiers, obviously, there's only a finite number that you can assign. So you have very few combinations. For instance, Chicago O'Hare is ORD. Why? It was built in an orchard.
Wow.
It's an abbreviation for orchard. It was built in, I believe, an apple orchard.
Wow.
So PWM, actually the Westbrook more came from where the last beacon was as aircraft approached the airport. It was in the Westbrook. It was a Westbrook beacon.
Huh.
So Portland Westbrook Municipal, PWM, but it was always the Portland Municipal Airport back then and then became the Portland International Jetport.
Boy, you know what?
Later.
If I was in Westbrook, I would promote that.
I would as well.
I would kind of capitalize and say, you know, the good people of Westbrook, we are connected. We are like almost equal to Portland in terms of the Jetport. The other question I had, and we're jumping around, but I think it's such an interesting topic. What makes it a Jetport versus an airport? Because I travel around, and it's kind of unusual even to be referred to or self-designated as a Jetport.
It is. There is no defined definition. We back in the late 60s, 1967, actually, when they relocated the terminal building and built a brand new one in basically the site of the current Jetport terminal building, there was the switchover from props to jet aircraft,
right.
And they took the term Jetport. And now it's really a great part of the lexicon. And because you can say, what other airport can you just say the name Jetport,
yeah.
And everybody locally knows where and what that is.
Yeah, it's kind of quirky, I've been on a couple of the, they're not Continental now, but the flights to Newark, there's still a couple aircraft that are propeller, right? I think I was in the last year on a prop plane that Newark, Portland is a prop.
Yes, that is correct. Yes, there's still one in existence. They are on the out overall.
Yeah,
but that still
is
has
that a, Continental? Is that what I'm thinking? What airline is
now United?
They
with
were
the Continental
taken over.
United merger.
Yeah, they painted that over. But yeah, it is. It is. I don't want to say it's uncomfortable because. Do I want to say it's uncomfortable?
Sure.
Well, maybe it's just me that's uncomfortable. But sitting on a little prop plane, it's very, very cozy.
Yeah, that one's a little better than the former 50-seat regional jets it has a slightly bigger interior. So and a little bit better seating, a little bit more overhead baggage. But again, that will be falling to the wayside of the new 70-seat regional jets, which is kind of the minimum our market is going to.
Yeah, it feels like the whole aviation business kind of shifts. And, I was watching some sort of special on the 747, which has been phased out. Now it's – and it has to do with how many engines on the plane or, for the jumbo jets, do they need three crew or two? And it's all about cost. But passenger comfort, I know that's not your department. But since we have you here, by the way, we have Paul Bradbury as the director of the Portland International Jetport. I know the airlines all say the same thing. We love our passengers, and I'm in marketing and advertising, and so I'm part of the hyperbolic machine. But everyone says, we want you to fly United, we want you to be happy, and we want you to have a big smile. But it feels like, I don't want to call it a commodity business, but when people are searching for travel, they're searching for price and time. And as much as we all complain about discomfort of travel, very few people have the luxury or kind of the desire to block out one airline or another. But what's the motivation for airlines to not give people more room? Because they've gotten so small and so tiny, and then the flight attendants are elbowing you in the head, and then you trip, and the airlines go, well, we're sorry, but it just keeps happening, and it feels like, and this is my final rant, and I'll let you answer this, Paul, but it feels like once a year, all the airline executives get to a planning room, and they're like, yeah, we've got revenue issues going on, we got this, what do you think we should do, and somebody raises their hand in the back of the room, and his name's Bobby, and it's like, yeah, Bobby, what do you think? Well, and since all the airline seats are on a track adjustable rail system, he goes, well, my idea is if we move them all up a half an inch or 1 inch, we pick up an extra row, and those 6 seats equal 8 flights a day times 300 flights a year because some of the days the plane's out of service. And we're going to make an extra $2 million worth of revenue on the plane. And then the executive looks at Bobby and says, genius, Bobby, genius. And they do it year after year. So what's your thought on that?
It gets even better. They've redesigned seat cushion material to take 1 inch out of every seat to add another row. But the word is that the new foam is much more comfortable.
Whose word is that? It's the airline's word. It's the seat manufacturer's word, right? I mean, that's the word.
That's the word. But what it all comes down to is we say we want the highest possible quality and maximum room. But the average person, the airlines are responding to the market, and the market
is price sensitive.
It is hugely price sensitive. So they are responding to the needs of their customer, and their customer says, "I want to pay the absolute least amount of money I can for this trip." And it's even brought whole new air carriers to the business, right? The Spirits, the ultra low cost are all about the lowest possible, and that's where even the introduction, we can continue the rant, of bag fees came from, is that people didn't want to pay for something if they weren't going to use it, and the market has just responded to that, right, wrong, or indifferent.
It's not just bag fees. By the way, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We've got Paul Bradbury. He is the director of the Portland International Jetport. 3 or 4 months ago, I took my son to Iceland. As a frequent TV viewer, there was a spot on the TV, or I read something somewhere. New airline with service from Boston Logan, not the Jetport, but Boston Logan to Reykjavik, and it's called WOW, and they were advertising these $99 seats, and I thought, God, I could go to Iceland, and we ultimately went. We traveled on WOW, which I'll tell you what happened. But we went on ATV tours and snowmobile tours, and we saw glaciers, and it was just a stunningly beautiful place, and it's only like four and a half hours from Boston. But, you know, so the airline seat was $99, but then with the fees and they did some other thing, it brought it up to $160. So Zach and I go to the airport, and we're checking in, and I have just a little briefcase and a little rollerboard. And as I'm checking in, the person says, "Well, you have to check your bag." And I go, "Well, no, I'm not checking a bag. I've got this." "No, no, no. Here at WOW, we only let you carry one little small thing." And I'm like, "Wow, really?" And they go, "Or and when you check it, it's going to cost you $99 more." And I said, "Wow." And then it was, "We have a headset for you and a pillow, but that's $19. Wow. And then I went on board, and every single little thing was, you know, they came just short of putting a little toll booth on the bathroom, which sooner or later somebody's going to think of that. You want to use the bathroom? Well, here you go.
$5.
But the one good thing on WOW, they make pizza on board.
Really?
Yeah, I think it was Southwest or somebody that would cook, make cookies, and I think that was, you know, every airline has their little thing. But WOW, For as painful as it was, another kind of cramp flight, but other than that, you know, it was a decent airline. But all of a sudden, it was like, well, we do have pizza on board. And as far as my son was concerned, they literally make pizza. You just push a button and a pizza shows up. So that was a good WOW. But yeah, the airline business keeps shifting like that, and it's very revenue sensitive, labor sensitive, fuel sensitive. Speaking of fuel, with prices almost collapsing in the last 2 years, and that's affected the global market for oil and gas and all that. And with that being the highest operating cost element for airlines, how have you seen that reflected relative to the relationship with airlines and pricing? Because I don't see prices coming down, but when fuel prices go up, all of a sudden the surcharges. And, you know, what kind of insight do you have in terms of the aviation fuel market?
Yeah, the aviation fuel market, just as you know, just as everybody sees when they go to the gas pump, is down. We're at all-time, you know, historical lows. And it's really gone to the airline's bottom line. If you look, who would have thought a decade ago that the airline stocks would be darlings? Right. But they are now. It's not a question of returning that back to the price. They've held it and they've banked that money, and you're seeing it in the capitalization of the airlines, which, I mean, we can all look. They were so many years unprofitable. I can say from my business perspective, it's just allowed us to have a better, you know, a profitable business partner is actually much easier to work with as we're doing things like renewing leases and working out arrangements and working on capital improvement programs. So for us, it's a much better day. We were looking at deals that were 3 years and less, because what's the agreements with an airline that may be in bankruptcy in 2 months isn't worth the paper it's written on. But now suddenly, when you're going to rating agencies and bonding doing debt, the airlines are – it's valuable again. Having a contract with an airline like Delta is valuable again. So we're looking at longer-term deals. So it's a very interesting market, but still the equipment you've even talked about, the two engines, the European flights with only two engines now, bringing the cost of what is only a four-hour flight across the pond, it's brilliant and it's very new with the new equipment that's online.
Yeah, it's new, but at the same time, from my perspective, and I've been traveling – dare I say how long I've been traveling?
You may.
Because I've been traveling since the 60s. In my airline experience, I recall early on as a kid traveling with my family, is you'd go to an airport like Logan back in the day, and every terminal had insurance machines, life insurance. And it was a normal day-to-day thing. And back then, there was a lot of hijacking. Hijacking was like every other Tuesday, somebody would hijack a plane to Cuba or somewhere. And it was just a very common thing. And you just think that after like one or two planes were hijacked, that somebody would figure out the answer. But it was just like, no, planes just get hijacked.
Oh, man.
But when you checked in, you literally were standing next to a machine and you put a dollar in or 50 cents and you bought life insurance at the gate when you were about to get on the airplane. And you look back at that and you think, God, what was the selling point?
That doesn't make for a very confident flight in my mind.
Well, it doesn't, because you're suggesting that, hey, you're entering this risky event, and if you want to put a dollar in now. And then the irony is that, you would obviously, pay for it and then jam it into the machine. And I don't want to make light of, aviation disasters, but if something ever happened to the plane, the only people that would know the policy was in there would be the people collecting them, The incentive would be for them to go, oh, we can't find the paperwork from this flight. Yeah.
Fortunately, we're well beyond that. Aviation is the safest way to travel. I have to just jump in on Steve-O on that one.
There's
no safer way to travel. And
more than car, boats, everything else.
It is. It is the safest way to travel. But you are at 30,000 feet, and that has a psychological factor.
Especially the closer you were to the advent of flight, now that there's just more history and there's more data and it's well received as just a really safe way to travel. But back in the 50s and 60s, it was a little bit like, good luck. Good luck on your flight. You may end up in Cuba. Good luck. We've got Paul Bradbury here. He's director of the Portland International Jetport. You were talking about some of the changes. The biggest and most visible was the huge project that you talked about, the capital improvement project that was almost $163 million. New parking garage, 137,000 square foot terminal expansion. I think it's beautiful. And then also want to talk a little bit about one of your private jetport operators are expanding. I think that's great for the area, for people that are doing, private aviation, that type of thing. But what are the plans for the rest of the airport? Because when you were here a year and a half ago, so there's one small section of the airport that I refer to as the old section. And you guys have tried to match the old to the new, and there's paint. I think there's a new piece of carpet over there. But there's one section of the airport that's state-of-the-art with these high ceilings, and it's beautiful. And then there's one section that looks like it was built decades and decades ago. What is, and I know it takes a long time for capital programs to kind of kick in, get funding, but what are the plans, and are there any plans to make the airport kind of completely renovated?
Yes. I mean, having two different looks or feels is, we certainly do not want two terminals. We want one terminal of the same quality and everybody to have the same excellent experience. So you nailed it. And we're actually looking in the 2017 program our fiscal year 2017, which will start July 1, to have one terminal. And you're right, it's gates 1 through 6. There's you hit Starbucks and go left, and just a little bit beyond that, you're into what would have been the old terminal. We don't want it to seem like the old terminal. We want it to be one terminal. It just happens to be gates 1 through 6.
And there are some airlines that are back through 1 through 6. I think United is back there. They have 1 or 2 or something like that. And so I've had friends and business colleagues fly in for meetings, and I've been like, hey, how do you like the new terminal? And they're like, what new terminal? And so depending on where you fly in and out of, you have a completely different experience. So if you fly into one of the old gates, you know, it's a nice, you fly, you know, it's functional, but it's certainly not as aesthetically pleasing as the new air, but you have a whole different experience.
Yeah, fortunately, we'll grab them on the way out because everybody has to go through ticketing. So we'll catch them then, and they'll when they leave, they'll say, wow, that was a great departure. And I have to admit, we had a gentleman, one of the inspectors from Delta, and he was just going and auditing terminals, and he'd never been to Portland post our terminal expansion. He's like, wow, I never expected a small hub to have this kind of impact and this kind of structure and to have done all these really interesting things. So it was brilliant. So even somebody in the business was very surprised by the level of structure we have.
We've got a couple in the region, and I'm obviously a big supporter of the Jetport, but Manchester, for years, they renovated 10 or 15 years ago, whenever that was. And that's also for a regional airport. I think that's also a first-class facility.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit about at the Jetport. I know the TSA function doesn't – that's the federal government runs that, and I believe under Homeland Security. But they seem to be doing a much better job, and they have this thing TSA Pre, which I've signed up on. Deb, are you a TSA pre?
I'm not. Well, no, I don't travel enough.
Well, there you go. Sully, anything pre? Nothing, nothing. Nobody's pre. Mm-hmm. Well, fantastic. That allows me to go through the airport quicker. and for those people listening that may not be familiar with it, maybe you can explain it. But my understanding, it's an identification program where in order for me to get my TSA pre number, I had to go downtown Portland. And it's a little bit of a higher hurdle in terms of 2 pieces of ID. You get fingerprinted, you get your picture taken. But once you get your number, it is a lighter security experience that you go through. So you don't take off your shoes. You don't have to take liquids out of your bag. You go through a different magnetic screener so you don't have to, you know, it's not, and it's much quicker. And depending on the airport, like I've been able to, like, for a 3 o'clock flight, go to the Jetport, pull into my little space on the 4th floor at the garage, because that's where there's less congestion. Everyone wants to park on 3 so they can go over the thing.
Yeah.
Rookie mistake.
Yeah.
Go up to 4, take a close space, jump on the elevator, and I've been able to, within 5 minutes, park my car and end up at my gate.
Wow.
And a lot of it has to do with the design of the airport, but also TSA Pre. So talk about how you work with the TSA and how that whole experience integrates into the airport.
TSA and security processing, as you well know, is huge. It's huge for the customer experience. If you arrive at the airport and you're waiting forever, or there's a facility issue, or there's an issue with screening, it's not a great way to start your travel experience. And certainly Pre has really moved the TSA in what I think is the right direction, in that you're saying, you give us some information, we know who you are, and we can do a little less on the security screening process. You can keep your laptop in the case. I mean, it's saying we know something about you, and you're not an individual that we're as concerned about, and we don't have to do the same level of screening to somebody that we know nothing about.
Right.
So it's a great process, and I think it's really helped those that travel a significant amount. I was coming through Orlando, and I have Pre as well, and I it was a huge, huge line if you weren't in the pre-check.
Yeah, because when you approach security, typically there's one section that's identified as TSA Pre and then one section for the hoarded masses. And that in itself can take a half hour, 45 minutes, depending on the airport.
I have to say, we have a great TSA team in Portland. In the surveys we've done, they come up time and time again as some of the top, from our passengers doing surveys on our security screening process, we come up at tops, you know, time and time again on rating our security. So TSA, at least in Portland, you know, they have a nice personality. They're friendly.
Sure.
And they process you very quickly is what we're seeing time and time again. So we really appreciate that.
I agree. I asked earlier, I forgot to follow up, but the business structure of the airport. Talk a little bit about how the budget and how the business operations are integrated within city government. Do you report to the city manager, John Jennings, and the Portland City Council that oversees and approves budget? And how much autonomy does the Jetport have, or is it really just a department or a function within the city?
It is a department of the city, and you're absolutely right that I do report to John Jennings, the city manager, and the city council. Our projects get approved by the city council. The city council, in some respects, you could call it a board of directors for what the Jetport does. But we are unique within the city of Portland in that we are an enterprise fund. So an enterprise fund, the revenues and expenses are all in their own bucket that is the Jetport. So the taxpayer of the city of Portland has no moral or real hazard to anything we do. They're not on the hook for the Jetport or its expenses or the bonded debt that it has outstanding.
And the Jetport is, I don't know if you refer to it as a public utility, but a public function. It's not designed as a profit center, but relative to revenue and expenses. Can you give us a little bit of a direction on, does it make money? Does it generate more revenue through fees and service fees than you spend? Or is it just an operating budget that the city absorbs as other operating budgets?
So you have it. The airport actually generates and covers all of its expenses. But at the end of the day, every dollar that's generated at the airport gets reinvested in the airport. So there's no City of Portland contribution to any function or any cost of the Portland International
Airport. So if you're a taxpayer in Portland or the area, you know, your tax money isn't going into the airport. It's just flowing through kind of the city government in terms of oversight. And when you have net revenue, you put it into a capital fund or a future fund, and then it just kind of recycles and grows.
Yes. As of now, we have, and it's what we call our fund balance, but we have, as the Jetport, over 500 days of operating cash on hand. And that's something we do, and it allows us to go onto the financial markets to borrow money in the future, which is different than a straight general obligation bond that the city might issue for its projects that it would do. We issue revenue bonds that are truly only supported by the revenues of the Jetport.
Right, got it. So as an example, looking at the winter budget, you know, obviously de-icing and salt and runway maintenance is a huge expense. So even though for skiers here in Maine that wish there was more snow, that's probably a positive impact for the budget, right?
Very positive. So far, the one storm, it was kind of a long storm there in the holiday season, but we banked a lot in the fall, so that's great. And something other people may not consider is that when we have icy, freezing rain, that's actually more expensive for us than if you have a nice, fluffy snow that's easy to plow.
Wow. Talk about the airport itself, how many runways there are, how many planes are handled or passengers. And I had a question. President Barack Obama visited a few years ago, and I was curious, did Air Force One, and I know whatever plane he is on or our president is on, it becomes the designated Air Force One, but what is the largest aircraft that either has or can land at the Portland International Jetport?
So there, the president has, and I believe at the time he may have brought the 757, but he's also come in Marine One before, which is the helicopters.
Right.
So we've had both Air Force One, not the 747. It was the, but we have daily service with a Boeing 757, which is a pretty good. And you'll say, well, who's flying the Boeing 757 every day?
Cargo.
Well, cargo, exactly right. It's FedEx, so every day the plane comes in and out. That's a great piece of equipment. That's our largest standard regularly operating plane. But we can go larger. We've had a...
Because a number of years ago, you extended either the runway or the lighting system. Wasn't there a federal grant that allowed you... Because you need to, you know, not only do you need asphalt to land, but you need the glide path and you need, you know, there's a lot of other variables.
That project was what we called a runway safety area. And so what the FAA learned is that they need overrun or underrun on each end of a runway. So they made it the top safety priority. And the deadline for all of those projects nationwide was in 2015, but they were called these essentially a 500-foot overrun or under hit for the runways to because they had problems with if an aircraft did exceed the length of the runway, it could cause big problems, as we would all guess.
Right.
So this little bit of extra distance makes a huge safety advantage overall. So it was FAA and Congress made it their highest priority to get those introduced, and we did. But it doesn't provide additional landing runway. It gives a higher safety if you do need more.
Deb, do you have a favorite approach coming into the jet pool?
No.
So you don't even travel. Do you ever travel?
When I do, I drive most of the time. I like driving.
Yeah, driving's good, but it's, you know, when you're going places further away than driving.
Yeah, like across the pond, that's probably a plane necessary for that.
Submarine pond, something. My favorite, and it's quirky, but there is, I don't know how many approaches there are, but the FAA has an approach, and I think it's called Harbor View or Harbor Approach, and it all depends on, you know, an air traffic control. They look at the wind. And generally, planes want to take off and land into the wind because of lift. This comes from my 3 months of taking pilot's lessons.
I'm very impressed.
3 months.
Yes.
I was in a Cessna 170, and I was like, after the three-month mark, you're either fully committed or you recognize I can't afford to get up at 20,000 feet or 10,000 feet and forget flaps up or down. And I took enough lessons to know and have enough respect for pilots and for aviation to realize that it is not a hobby. You know, like if you're doing photography and you forget the aperture or you forget the, you know, ISO setting, you know, not a lot of damage comes from over or under exposing some wildlife photo.
Right.
But if you're a pilot, there's a lot of technical stuff. And I got to the point where I was taking weekly flying lessons, and I skipped a week or something, and I was getting ready to solo. And I'm like, airspeed, approach, flap, angle. I don't remember one of those.
Oh, dear.
And that's when I think that's the warning sign. But back to the approach. There's an approach, you know, so there's the FAA has like literally highways in the sky where there's like giant roads and there's paths and there's beacons, and you know, Paul knows all that much better than I do. But there's one approach, if the wind is right, that loops around out into the ocean and literally comes down Casco Bay. It comes around the headlight, and then it comes down the middle of the old port, Casco Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to have an office on Commercial Street.
Yeah.
And there would be times where I'd be flying in and right behind DeMillo's, and I could look in the window to see if people were working. But it's a beautiful approach. And every time I've talked to pilots, they all say that it's one of the nicest approaches they have.
Oh, it is, and it's called the Harbor Visual. So
the
you're
Harbor
right
Visual,
on.
Yeah,
I'm,
yeah.
I'm just amazed that you have all
three
this
months
stuff
of pilot's
this is
lesson.
Great.
Three it's, months of pilot's license.
Pilots do love that approach. And actually, the Wall Street Journal front page a few years back said pilots' favorite approach to an airport. Ours was on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, right at the top of the newspaper.
Nice.
So it was and who would have thought? But it is. It's beautiful. You go right by the Cape Elizabeth, so you see Portland Headlight.
Right.
It's gorgeous.
Go over
and
to
pilots
Fort Gorges, which is gorgeous.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. No, but it's – and then the other approach, which is the other more common approach, kind of goes over the mall area. And you're,
right.
And – not as nice.
No.
No,
definitely.
But I mean, so I will sometimes, when I get on a plane, you know, sometimes the pilot, you know, Captain Billy is there. Hey, how you doing? Like he's looking for little kids to give jet wings to, that type of thing. And then here I come on board, big goofy guy. And I go, hey, Captain Billy, are we going to Harbor View or Harbor Visual? And he's like, well, how do you know about that? I go, well, I don't know. I took 3 months of pilot's
license. There you go.
And depending on the wind, he goes, yep, I think I think that's what we're locked in. We'll see how it goes as we get closer. Because if the wind shifts, you don't want to, you know, you got to be into the wind.
Yeah.
And just for our listeners, the real benefit of the Harbor Visual approach is that it keeps the aircraft over the water.
It was noise
not
abatement.
Over people. It came out of a noise abatement program because the sound pressure is less to residential areas.
So you didn't even know I knew noise abatement, did you, Deb?
I did not know that.
God, I know all these terms.
I'm going to remember that.
I didn't even know I knew. I didn't even know. By the way, we have Paul Bradbury here. He's the director of Portland International Jetport. And so relative to the scope of the jet port? Are airline flights going up? Are passenger numbers going up? And what metrics do you use looking at travel to see if things are going forward or back in terms of numbers?
I'm actually very pleased to say that this has been a great second half the second half of 2015 was exceptional. We had all-time records for five of the past 7 months, and we're still waiting on December data to come in. So the things we use is obviously we're at the end of the day, it all comes down to passengers on aircraft is what makes our numbers and what we're interested in. So and the way the industry does that is something called emplanements, and that's just a person getting on an airplane. So every person that gets on an airplane is tagged as an emplanement. If you get off an airplane, you're a deplanement. So that's what we track. And then the sum of those is total passengers, not to get too into math here.
Right.
So the past all-time records for five of the past 7 months, and November, we were up 12.7%.
Wow.
On passengers in November. So
what about the people that buy the chapstick for $5 in the gift shop with like the 400% profit margin? That's me. I can't keep hold of a chapstick, so I'm always buying like the $5 chapstick at the gift shop in the airport.
Well, you're helping the non aeronautical revenues for the jetport, and we thank you very much.
Outstanding. The control tower. I'm interested in aviation, and every time there's a Discovery Channel thing, you know, whether it's on Air Force One or 747s or the retirement of the supersonic plane that used to British Airways and Air France used to, you know, the Concorde. So air traffic controllers, to me, I think are kind of fascinating. And there's been movies about it. There's been TV shows because it's a dramatic job function. Because when everything is going normal the way it should, I'm sure there are periods of just mundane time and then flights are coming in. But to me, it's fascinating, the psychology of you're up in this tall building and you are the voice that are connecting, you know, a metal tube hurling through space that wants to get on the ground. And you've got radar, you're sitting all that has to be under the jurisdiction of the FAA, but relative to being at the airport, is there any connection at all, or is that a separate building? Do you ever get to go into the tower and say, hey, guys, everything's going well. Is the coffee machine doing all right? You guys happy? Or is it just completely a separate function at the airport?
The FAA does own and operate and control the air traffic control tower, but I do go up to the control tower occasionally, and it is fun to do so. It's a good viewpoint from up there. But I can tell all of the listeners that if you go up to the fifth level of the parking garage, you are at parity with the air traffic control tower.
The same height.
The same height. So you can see the airfield. You can wave to the controllers. They're very visible at that level. That's one of the beauties. In fact, when we were building that parking garage, people thought the elevator tower that we were building was a new air traffic control tower.
Wow.
Who would have thought?
Well, I know, but you just demystified it. To compare it to the fifth floor of the parking garage being similar, I want it to be something epic. I want it to be like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise it's...
Oh, come on. That's asking a lot.
Well, okay. In the last few minutes we have Paul Bradbury, the director of the airport. What type of either innovations or changes or new flights or new just new things happening in the jetport can people look forward to? And as part of that question, before we do these interviews, Sully, a.k.a. Emily Sullivan, who's our producer here, does a great job of providing notes and background and, you know, what's going on. And she provided a question. It's kind of a funny question. How important is the new Portland to Melbourne flight, direct flight? It must be born from some personal interest she has in Melbourne, because it just seems like such a quirky question. But yeah, how important is the new Portland to Melbourne direct flight? And what's new that passengers or people in Maine can look to in terms of different flights, different destinations, and different things at the airport?
So Florida is our top, you know,
as a state,
it's our top destination.
Orlando, Disney, Miami for deep suntanning.
It's warm. We're right now in the first quarter. It's January. It's now getting cold. So there is a unique connection to the Florida market. There's no question on that front. It is our heaviest state for travel out of Portland if we look at destinations.
Right.
So to have a – and it's our most underserved. So – and there's a little subtlety here I should probably mention. So a nonstop means you get on a plane and you arrive at your destination. And a direct flight could be that you stop but you stay on the same plane. So little inside ball here.
I did not know that.
So nonstop, one plane. So this is nonstop service to the Melbourne area, which is a reasonable drive, just an hour to Orlando, but you're near Cape Canaveral. So it gives us the East Coast of Florida, and anything we can do to get nonstop service to a state that is the most popular for our region.
Right.
Let's do it. So that's its importance.
Because otherwise, Atlanta is a big hub, obviously, with Delta. And so a lot of people heading down to Florida probably go through Delta or connect through JFK with JetBlue, something like that.
And we do have direct flights on Southwest and a few nonstops on Southwest seasonally to the Orlando market.
And what about the economy? You know, everything in Maine seems like it's tied to our economy and having a relatively weak economic engine. Transportation, whether it's highway access, whether it's shipping, and certainly air transportation, plays such an incredible role in terms of any vibrant economy. Does the Jetport work with Maine tourism to attract visitors, to create, make the airport an asset relative to really what I think is our biggest industry, which is tourism? And so how does tourism connect with the functionality of what in effect is an airport?
Oh, it's huge. And for us, we as Portland and as Maine have a brilliant product for, you'd love to say that the Jetport, but we're not an island. And what's happening and what makes our market so amazing is that there are a lot of people that want to come to Maine. They want to come to Portland. Why is that? Maine has a huge amount to offer for business and leisure and tourism, as you say, the largest industry in the state.
Right.
And it's amazing how much we're getting now. We're in top 10 lists, Portland, the foodie town, state of Maine, Acadia National Park. What we're trying to work with on this is really to work on the seasons, because we do twice as many passengers in the summer, July, August, as we do in January, February. But Maine has a lot to offer even in the winter. And that's where we're working with the Office of Tourism to really work together to bring up what I call our seasonal trough. And that makes us a more robust market when we're looking at airlines and getting more service into the state.
Interesting. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk, WLOB, 1310 AM. We have Paul Bradbury, Director of Portland International Jetport. In the last couple of minutes, we've been talking really about commercial flights and kind of the commercial presence at the Jetport, which is really the kind of the engine, the core. But there's two other key, or at least two other key areas, and that is private flight. And there was a recent announcement in the last week that local company, Northeast Air, has signed a lease extension with the Jetport, and they've committed to a new facility that'll cost about $3 or $5 million. So the private aircraft business is pretty big. And then also you mentioned FedEx, and I'm sure UPS and other freight companies. How important are those two other kind of legs of the stool, whether it's private aircraft or freight coming in and out of the airport?
They're very important. And just in our overall market mix, we run 67% of our revenues are not from the airlines, so which is huge.
Wow.
I mean, rental cars, our in-building concessions, our other FBOs, which this is, and people listening will say, well, what's an FBO? It stands for fixed-based operator. And they are the servicing. They're like the gas station on the airport. But what's really interesting about FBOs, unlike when you're driving your car to a service station, planes need to fly. So when they get there, they only have the options that are at that airport, because they need to get checked out. They need fuel, but they can't just drive down the street to pick an alternative.
Right.
So the huge part of our FBO private investment is that we will now have two. Maine Aviation is doing a facility on the south side, and Northeast Air is doing one on the north end of the expanding and improving theirs on the north end. So this gives us market competition for those services at the airport, and it's all private investment. It's not airport money. So and it's not – they do a huge amount of management of private aircraft and servicing of private aircraft.
De-icing. They have contracts with the airlines, I guess,
correct,
for the de-icing.
And they also – but they also do the fueling for our air carriers at Portland. So it even impacts our commercial air service and gives another opportunity for them to have another service or fueling operation going on at the jet port.
What about freight? You mentioned FedEx runs a 757. Is that out of Memphis? Is that where they come out of the hub? And, you know, so that's the big plane that takes most of the FedEx packages out of Memphis into Portland. But there must be other carriers too, right?
Well, you follow aviation very well. It is. It's Memphis.
I want to be a pilot.
Here.
I'm
shocked how much
noise
you know.
Abatement, freight, Memphis.
Very impressive.
Fred Smith, the founder. I know. Yeah, I know a bunch of different kinds.
So we for air cargo, we're limited now just to FedEx. There was Airborne with DHL, but with DHL pulling out of the U.S. domestic market, where we have FedEx. UPS has a large ground-based freight facility just on the other side of the airport on Foden Road, and then they trucked actually to Manchester.
Got it.
But FedEx is important. Part of the charges that we use to keep the airfield open is called a landing fee. So when an aircraft lands, we get revenue from that. But again, even on the landing fees, all in and everything we collect from the airlines is still – you know, less than 40% of the revenues we collect, which is amazing. And here's another fact that probably the listeners wouldn't realize, but last year, for our last fiscal year, our rental cars in Portland, Maine, little Portland, Maine, grossed over $30 million in sales right out of the Portland jet.
No, $30 million in rental cars.
That's huge.
It is huge. And people have no idea of the scale of that operation at the Portland Jetport. And I just throw that out because that is one of our largest.
That's like $800,000 a week. That's over $100,000 a day.
You're good on math, but now put it into basically a single quarter because most of that business occurs in June, July, and August.
Really?
That's the economic impact.
There you go.
So you can't get to Acadia National Park from the jetport without a rental car or without a friend to drive you.
Can't go to Bar Harbor. You can't go to Bar Harbor. You need a GPS and you need all that.
Good
well,
this
was so much fun. I always appreciate when you come by because I think the airport does a fabulous job of serving the city and the state and the region. And I think it's one of our bright spots in terms of it's the first impression that people get of Maine when they fly in, if they go by plane, and it's the last impression. So I think that's always critical. And, you know, thank you and all the folks you work with at the airport for doing such a great job.
Yeah, thank you so much. We do have a wonderful team at the jetport of nearly 1,000 employees, like I said, even though only 50 work for the city.
Right. But those are the 50 of the really good ones, right? I'm kidding. They're all good, all the airport. Hopefully you'll come back sometime soon, and good luck there at the airport.
Thank you so much.
Great. Great having Paul Bradbury as the airport director of the jetport. Anyone interested in information, their website is portlandjetport.org, and they do a great job for the city and the region. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. We'll be back next week. Thank you.